Robert Fontaine is here, and he has seen the new documentary that explores the artistic universe of the Group of Seven. It's called Painted Land, In Search of the Group of Seven. But Robert has also been to see some of the films presented at the Ottawa International Film Festival. He's with me now in studio. Hello there.
Hello. Yeah, I've been watching some indie films. Indie being, I guess everyone knows, small budget, or in some cases, micro budget films.
Yes.
That are striving for wider exposure. You know, Alan, to make a strong film, you don't need a lot of money, okay? What you need generally is a good script, a good story to tell, and a story that is adapted to your budget.
Yes.
You must possess the technical means that allow you to tell the story. For example, it's not a good idea to shoot a sci-fi story if you have no budget, and the story calls for aliens and alien technology. Your movie is going to look, at best, cheesy.
Yes.
Unless you are a genius, as Edward L. Kahn was, and you come up with a concept called Invisible Invaders, in which the aliens and all of their technology is invisible. Brilliant. No-budget filmmaking. Great. 1959.
Oh, hit me in the jaw. You need a strong cast. You need the person who's going to look like they're getting hit by the invisible alien.
Yeah.
Because audiences are unforgiving of bad acting.
Unforgiving. Well, in my experience, though, I think, unless the actors absolutely stink, if the audience gets caught up in the story, it will forgive just about anything, I think.
Okay, yeah.
But as a critic, there's something that I'm seeing much too often in small budget movies, and it's getting to me.
All right, what is that?
Okay, bad lighting.
Oh, excellent point. Yes.
Okay. Aspiring filmmakers everywhere, hear my plea. Light your movies. Light them. So I can see what the heck is going on screen. And not only underlit films, not only scenes that are underlit, but scenes that are where no real or not much thought or effort has gone into the lighting or even using the practical lighting, that is to say the lighting that appears in the scene. So that what happens is everything winds up looking very flat.
Right.
And your movie looks amateurish because of that. And, you know, I don't want to get too technical here, but you know, digital technology allows you to shoot in practically no light.
Right.
But the fact that the exposure is okay, is that doesn't mean that it's sufficient.
You know, you want to be able to use the lighting for something.
Lighting is super important. It creates mood. It creates atmosphere. It adds emotion. It can add depth to a story, to a character. I think that some young directors believe that darkness adds mystery and atmosphere. But if it's too dark, the poor audience, you know, I mean, not to mention the poor critic, is left to fumble about in the dark and maybe trip over the furniture and I'll hurt myself or something. But worse, much worse, the audience might lose interest.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, even big budget. I remember when the second the Batman Returns film came out, they had to actually re-release it with a lightened look because
yeah,
it was
ridiculously
too dark.
Yeah.
So you're making a general comment about indie films here, but is this specific to any of the movies you
watched
this week?
I'll mention a movie I saw called Wild Like, which is screening on Saturday at the Ottawa International Film Festival. It's about a teenage girl visiting her uncle in Juneau, Alaska. And her uncle makes some advances. Obviously, these are very unwanted. Mm. She runs away, winds up hooking up with a backpacker, a middle-aged man who's hiking out in the Alaskan wild. And they form a bond, okay? He's recently widowed. She's frightened and confused. He becomes a kind of father figure and a protector. Much of the story takes place against the spectacular backdrop of Alaskan rivers and mountains, okay? Mm. Very beautiful. Very well photographed. But when the movie moves indoors, particularly the early crucial scenes between the girl and her uncle, it's positively opaque.
Okay?
And because the movie takes its time getting in gear, we spend a lot of time early on in the dark, and this for me was a real problem.
Huh.
A real problem.
So does the movie work?
Well, it does have some good elements. I mean, it's a very good cast, and there are a few strong scenes between the girl and the older man. The older man is played by Bruce Greenwood, who you might remember as Captain Pike in the reboots of Star Trek there. The movie is sabotaged by its script. You know, I kept waiting for these two characters, these two wounded characters, to really connect, to really talk, and they never really do. And the way that the events unfold, it's hopelessly contrived, very illogical. Nobody behaves like they would behave in a situation like this. The ending, will have some people howling. Hmm. It's the cinematic equivalent of, sorry kids here, this is a retro reference. It's the equivalent of taking the needle off the record. You know, like just, I like movies that don't wrap everything up in a neat package. And I am a believer in stoking the audience's creativity. But after trailing along on this meandering road trip for an overlong 140 minutes, I felt that I deserved better than to be left hanging.
Okay.
You know, so I would not recommend this film.
Okay. Wild Lake is being screened as part of the Ottawa International Film Festival. The festival starts tomorrow, runs until Sunday. Consult the official website for screenings and events at oiff.ca. A lot going on there. We're going to be talking about another of the events happening tomorrow on the show.
Okay.
Now, Robert, you've been to see a movie you did like, though.
Yes.
Painted Land, In Search of the Group of Seven.
Yeah. I live right next to the Gatineau Park, and it is gorgeous this time of year.
Mm.
You know, the proverbial riot of color. Painted Land is a gorgeous film. It's shot around Georgian Bay and the north shore of Lake Superior in the fall.
Probably good lighting right there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So what is going on here?
Well, we follow two wilderness photographers, a couple, Joni and Gary McGuffin. I thought it was very funny that they named McGuffin. I had immediate images of Hitchcock films. But... And they have a friend, an art historian, Michael Birch. And what they're doing is they're searching for the actual locations that have become so iconic in the paintings of the Group of Seven, paintings of A.Y. Jackson and J.H. MacDonald and Lauren Harris, to name only those three.
Now,
so they're looking for the places.
I love that idea, though.
It's a really neat
visiting
idea.
The places and see where the artists were when they painted the masterpieces.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we come full circle. I mean, art imitating life, imitating art, right?
Mm.
Do many of these places even still exist?
Hmm.
I mean, we're talking about trips to the wilderness that the Group of Seven made 100 years ago, about, you know, over 100 years ago. So if you can find this spot, is it still pristine? Will the places look like their paintings? There's a quote used in the film from J.E.H. MacDonald. He said, "The most important thing a painter can do is find a good place to sit." Now, if the film was just kind of a wilderness road movie, you know, with our searchers canoeing and hiking in this gorgeous landscape and then calling up the original paintings and holding them up to compare the views.
Hmm.
I think this would still be a satisfying film, aesthetically pleasing, but there's a lot more to it. The director is Phyllis Ellis. She makes very good use of archival material.
Hmm.
And MacDonald, J.H. MacDonald, kept extensive diaries of his travels with the group. So we get a lot of insights into the group's inner workings, you know. It's a real treasure trove if you're a Group of Seven junkie, or if you just love these paintings. It's a real treasure.
I love it also because it just emphasizes that idea of the other role of paintings. Not that things are necessarily done for archival purposes, but the idea that we do lose things over time, and they're preserved forever on those canvases.
Absolutely.
I'm guessing this is a film that you'd want to see on the big screen.
Yeah, this one would be breathtaking in IMAX. It's really remarkable when you superimpose a painting over the actual physical place, and you see how they really captured, for lack of a better term, the spirit of the place.
Mm-hmm.
In his book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Robert Persig said, "The only Zen you find on the tops of mountains is the Zen you bring up there with you."
Hmm.
And I was thinking about that as I was watching this film, because these paintings are such a part of my consciousness. And I felt really exhilarated to be almost out there or in the painting.
Yeah.
You know, many years ago, I used to go to the National Gallery and I would sit for a long time in front of Lauren Harris's North Shore Lake Superior.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites. And for me, it represented it was very spiritual. It was a kind of oasis of calm and of hope. That light shining down on the ancient tree stump, you know. I've always found a kind of solace in that painting, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the idea that the film is able to take you into it, literally, great. It would be great to see it in IMAX. So I highly recommend it.
Great film for all ages. It's beautiful. It's educational. It's an adventure. The MacGuffins, you know, they spent years canoeing and backpacking and researching, trying to find these places. And you feel the thrill along with them when they pull out a picture of a painting and they hold it up and they say, "There, there." And this is where he was sitting when he painted it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Canada was looking for its identity 100 years ago, and an important part of what came to define the national psyche was, you know, the Group of Seven, were those Canadian landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are 100 years later on the eve of an election, you know, still dealing with questions of identity, dealing with realities and problems that those painters could never have imagined. And, you know, we're still trying to define what we're all about and where we're going, where we want to go. And still these paintings speak to us because at the heart of the art is spirit and this yearning, I think, for a unity, you know, to be one with nature, to be one with one's natural surroundings so that you disappear into the landscape. That's a very Zen concept, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's what I get when I look at these paintings. And that's what the film evokes and very beautifully.
All right. Painted Land in Search of the Group of Seven has a running time of 90 minutes. It's going to be screened at the Mayfair Theater next Wednesday and Thursday, October 21st and 22nd at 7. It's also getting its broadcast premiere tonight on TVO. At 9, and again on October 17th at 9, and the 18th at 11 p.m. That being said, Rivera, you're recommending people see it on the big screen.
Oh, yeah, come on. The experience will be greatly enhanced if you see this at the movies. Take your kids out to see it. Yeah. Make it into an adventure, you know. It really has to be seen on a big screen.
All right. Amazing. We got through an entire film review, not one baseball reference.
Okay. Well, you want to talk about the bat flip?
Yeah.
Soon to be a major motion picture.
That's what we need. That's the indie film waiting to happen.
And of course, Ken Taylor sadly passed away, and we were talking about Argo and Our Man in Tehran.
Yeah. Man in Tehran, 2013, I think, was Robert reviewed that.
So. The real story.
Yeah. Rent that.
Rent that first before you.
Before Argo. Learn the full story.
He was a great guy.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.